This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 2 years after the dot-com explosion, the smoke has begun to clear over the Internet. Contrary to the hype, capitalism was not revolutionized. On the other hand, the catastrophe was not complete. A few scarred survivors stand victorious on the field of battle amid the corpses of business models gone bust. On this first day of the new year, we look at the resurgence of the digital economy, future winners, and the lessons of the losers. Later this hour, we'll take a technological step back to the art and obsession of record collecting. But first, we'll revisit the business of the Internet. What makes money online and why? What's the future? We'll also look at attempts to archive this ephemeral medium and whether a society drowning in data is any richer in knowledge. Tech entrepreneurs, investors, working stiffs, if you bet on the right horse, call and tell us what led you right. If you were among the millions who were burned, do you want to play again? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from his home in New York City is George Manis, a senior writer for TheStreet.com. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Neil.
So those scarred victors, who are they? Who's standing on the web? Who's making money?
Well, the victors are, it's mostly the people who climb to the top of the heap and stayed there. You have really some of the famous names that everybody who is on the net has heard of. There's Yahoo, eBay, the auction site, Amazon, the e-commerce site.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just lots of other people who have found their niches and have managed to stay alive.
Well, how do these non-retailer sites making cash?
The non-retailer sites, well, one huge thing that has really helped over the past 2 years or so is the rise of search engine advertising. It used to be that you went to, let's say, Yahoo, and you said, I want to find out, let's say, a magic shop on the Internet,
mm-hmm.
and some human or maybe some machine had figured out some way to give you a list of some plausible choices for you to go to. And really where the action is, much of the action has been in Internet advertising is search engine advertising, which means instead of that human or that machine putting those names right at the top of the list, it's some advertiser who has said, you know, I'm going to pay I promise to pay Yahoo or somebody else 50 cents every time my listing comes up and an Internet user clicks on that listing to come to my site.
Mm-hmm. So advertising, which was seen as a huge engine a couple of years ago before the bubble burst, that's proved to be valid in some circumstances.
Oh, yes, it has. And even in that's perhaps been the biggest success story within advertising, paid search. But also what we would call, you know, traditional online advertising, what started out as the sort of the bumper sticker type banner ad and has grown into the huge full-page ads that sort of confront you every time you might go to a major website, those are doing rather well, too.
What about subscription companies? Are some of them working?
Well, yes. I, in fact, happen to work for one of those, which is TheStreet.com. And we are supported in part by advertising, and also through subscription to online products.
And that's pretty much the way that regular newspapers make their living, too.
Right, except you pay the cost of printing it out on your computer. We don't send you the paper.
Okay, and the retail sites, those are doing well. I noticed that there were reports of during the Christmas holidays that online sales had been surprisingly strong.
Oh, yes. Those companies, which are still around, have done rather well. I think Visa had some sort of statistic where they said overall holiday spending, judged by use of Visa cards, was up maybe in the teens, but online spending was up 50% over holiday season spending last year, which is it demonstrates, you know, I think what a lot of people sort of know in their gut, that, you know, sometimes the easiest thing to do is just plop down in front of the computer with a credit card and get whatever you want to buy sent to you or to a loved one.
Let's get a caller involved. And if you'd like to join the conversation, by the way, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's start with Johnny, who's on the line with us from Winston, Massachusetts.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I have a somewhat non-traditional approach now that I had done so poorly in my more traditional approaches to investing. And I have recently invested in an online company that specializes in selling products and services to adult consumers, pleasure products and services.
That's actually extremely traditional. I mean, that is the one thing that always made money on the Internet.
I was finally...
Adult products and adult-related products. There's always a market for that.
Yeah, this company is doing particularly well. In fact, they have a couple of very unique services that are just not available by any other company. They've got some proprietary technologies. Very interesting stuff.
So, Johnny, are you planning to invest more in other kinds of online companies? Or just...
I was an early investor in this one company, and I'm going to invest a great deal more money now that they're raising funds again to fuel an expansion.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, and Happy New Year to you, Johnny.
To you.
There's a happy investor. There were so many people burned a couple of years ago that George Manis, a lot of them say they're not willing to try it again.
Well, I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable takeaway. You know, people got burned in all sorts of sections of the market.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to go onto the Internet to lose money.
No. It was an equal opportunity bear market.
Right. You could do it in real traditional stuff like telecommunications, too, or more traditional technology like that, too.
Is the bloodletting in the tech sector over, do you think?
Overall tech sector, I wouldn't dare say it's over. But among the companies that I look at, mostly internet companies. I look at media companies too, but among the internet companies that I look at, I would sort of say that virtually all of the companies that are going to go out of business have gone out of business. The people who are just going to, you know, run out of capital, the people who, you know, just couldn't find a business model that worked. Most of them, you know, went out of business in 2001 and even in 2002. And this year, it's pretty much, you know, the grasshoppers, or excuse me, the ants who made it through the winter.
Mm-hmm. So pieinthesky.com is no longer with us.
Yeah, or if it is, it's being done out of a garage. You know, it's like a single, you know, a mom and pop proprietor type thing. There were a lot of great ideas out there, but they really didn't support the huge organizations that were built up in anticipation of huge revenues, which never arrived.
Now, the companies that you were talking about, you know, eBay, Amazon, Yahoo, and I guess Google, which may be going public later this year, and that's a pretty hotly anticipated IPO. There's a phrase we haven't heard in terms of the net for quite some time.
No.
But those are, again, the scarred survivors. Anything new happening?
Anything new happening? I think you really have to. I think the newest thing the most interesting thing that's happened in my mind among those is Yahoo purchased a company last year, Overture Services, which was basically the company that invented that search engine advertising business. That I talked about. Maybe they, you know, they didn't quote unquote invent it, but they ended out on top. They certainly led the market over the past 3 years in that particular business. So Yahoo buying them was an acknowledgement that, you know, this is, in my opinion, it was a correct acknowledgement that this is really not a fad. This is what people look to the Internet for usefulness. And people who are on the Internet and are searching for something have a goal in mind. And if you can get in front of that person as an advertiser, you've got, you know, a lot of your hard work out of the way.
Sometimes what people are going on the Internet to search for is other people. Social network companies seem to have developed rapidly over the last couple of years.
Well, I think that's an example. That's a there are a lot of these companies like Friendster and Tribe and LinkedIn, which sort of all go on are all sort of built on the idea that there is value to be found in friends of friends. You don't want just to perhaps go to an online dating site and find, you know, look through, comb through everybody in New York City. What perhaps is more useful is to go through and find all the single friends of friends of friends of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And these, this is actually like the dot-com boom all over again, because you have a lot of, you have venture capitalists putting, you know, a few million dollars into each of these companies. You have a lot of enthusiasm. You have a few stories in the paper saying, you know, this really changed my life. But if you look at them, they're all privately held, and they're all not making any money, and they all expect to be making money somewhere around the corner.
Oh, that,
just don't know.
That does sure sound familiar. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Shay, who's with us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
Thanks for having me.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, basically, when I was 20 years old, I started a company out of my apartment with a friend of mine, and our plan was to do internet video. And basically, the first 6 months, we managed to bring on about $500,000 just from friends and family, and raised another $60 million about 6 months after that. And that was right around when the internet bubble burst.
Ah, so you were caught up in the explosion, I take it.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say. I remember having a conversation with my dad when we first started it, and he was just you know, asking me exactly how we made money, and I didn't really have an answer for him. And it's funny, because at the time, that didn't really seem important.
I see.
At what point did you, I'm sort of curious, at what point did you see, did it become apparent to you, was there a particular event or something that happened where you just realized, like, uh-oh, we're not going to get any more investment money in, and we're not going to make enough money to keep us going?
Well, basically, it's funny, the timing of the internet bubble bursting was right around the time when we needed to get another, you know, big round of money in. And kind of because of that, the venture capital firm that we're working with kind of took us for all they're worth. Is, you know, basically what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to get as much value of the company as they can. So,
if Shay, the opportunity came up again, would you be willing to try it again?
Oh yeah, definitely. I worked for that company for a little under 2 years, and basically, after that time, me and a couple other friends kind of got burnt out and moved out here to Boulder and started up another company. But we
it's much, not collateraldamage.com, is it?
Much different company though. We ran much smaller. We raised much less money, and you know, we actually figured out that we need to make revenue from, you know, day one.
So you can now describe the product that you sell.
Yeah, yeah, and we actually try to make money off of it.
George Manish, it sounds like people like Shay learned some lessons.
Yeah, I mean, it is it actually does make me nostalgic for the old days. I almost would have preferred not to learn all these lessons. I kind of liked it back then when you could, you know, get a, you know, few $100,000 or a few $1 million for a business and not have a clear idea of how it was going to end up. It's sort of like, I guess, you know, the way some people, you know, put together a movie or put together a play. You know, it's like I got this gut feeling it'll work out well in the end. And it was an extremely, you know, liberating time, and people had a lot of cool ideas. But unfortunately, you know, the harsh light of day in terms of, you know, economic realities put it all to an end.
Shay, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
And when you make your $250,000,000, don't forget us, okay?
I'll give NPR $50 or something.
There you go. More of your calls when we come back from a break as we continue to discuss the dot-com revival. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about where the dot-com market is heading with George Manis, senior writer for TheStreet.com. Of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, or email us, TOTN@NPR.org. And, George, I have to ask, a lot of people are still uncomfortable putting things like credit card numbers on the net, and they're of course, the proliferation of worms and viruses has been in the news much this past year, and that, of course, along with identity theft, the stealing of those credit card numbers. Is that hurting the Internet economically?
If it is, I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, as those retail statistics indicate, you know, as you know, Visa, I'm sure, would be on top of things. They would see it in their numbers if people just didn't want to use their credit cards online. I think it's gotten to, all these things have gotten to, used to be excuses for as to why people didn't buy on the Internet, and now they're just sort of hassles, but not excuses.
Let's get another caller in. This is David from Ellsboro, Oregon.
Happy Hug Money.
Thanks very much.
I just have a brief comment. And that is that I am a semi-professional bagpiper, and the Internet has been an absolute boon for me in my profession, and that is that it is the one resource that I can go to find the esoterica related to my profession. It used to be a few years ago that it was practically impossible to find diverse sources of the various kinds of, you know, minutia related to
bagpipe supplies, or
exactly bagpipe supplies and Scottish supplies, Highland supplies,
fresh haggis. It's hard to find in Portland.
Exactly. Well, you know, there's one store here, but the Internet has made it possible for me to buy things from Scotland and England and New Jersey and Canada and so on, and the stores which I purchase from have been on the net now for 3-4 years and consistently turn a profit. And most of them also maintain a storefront, excuse me, which I find interesting that they not only have a physical storefront, but they also have virtual storefronts where they do a significant amount of business.
Maybe not brick and mortar, but thatched roof storefronts in this case. George Manis, it sure does seem like, you know, that collection of weird little shops that used to exist in New York City, Manhattan below 14th Street, that sold these strange little things, they're all on the net now.
Yeah, and I think David makes gets at an incredibly important point here, which is that it has, along with Amazon, which is kind of a place you go that sells like a little bit of everything, that you have all these wonderful, incredibly specialized stores that, you know, could not support themselves on foot traffic in a particular geographic location. You know, for example, a few months ago, I needed, you know, replacement blade for my electric shaver. And I went to the store where I bought it, which is a pretty huge electronics store, and they didn't have it. And I went on the Internet, and lo and behold, there was a place, and I wish I could remember the URL, but it was something like, you know, electricshaverparts.com.
That's right. Something really complicated.
There, and yeah. I got exactly what I needed.
David, good piping to you.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. The Skrull will wait for it. Let's see if we get another caller in. This is Dino in Edison, New Jersey.
Yes, hi. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
I'm a carpenter, and the only thing I have, the only experience I have with computers, I actually use them to support my plywood, so I can cut my plywood from leftovers computers. Anyway, I started some new business, and we're selling through the Internet, and we're doing very well so far. And I'd like to know, are there any ways that we can find good sources for investors, how we find the investors?
Venture capitalists, where can Dino find them?
Well, what you start doing is you start going online and you read publications like maybe CNET.com, or you go to read the San Jose Mercury News online, and there's lots of talk there about what venture capitalists you know, who's out there. But if I'm not sure that I quite understood what business it was that you wanted to get into.
Dino, you're a carpenter, and you...
Yes, I'm a carpenter, and we start making tools, actually, for carpentry.
Carpentry tools.
Carpentry tools. I have to say that this is a sort of thing that a lot of these venture capitalists, it's going to be a very tough uphill climb for you to convince them that the carpentry tool business is big enough potentially to make it even, you know, worth their while for them, you know, to meet with you and to, you know, get a lawyer to write up the papers, even if they are vaguely interested in something like this. This, I think, is one of these things where you've got to look to other sources, either, you know, funding it by yourself. It might be the sort of, it used to be the situation was, you know, the venture capitalist was like your grandma. You could go to them and the pocketbook was always open, and it seemed as if they were willing to spend money on almost anything. But I think those days are gone, and that strikes me as a very sort of tough sell for them. You'd have to look at a more traditional ways to finance it, like maybe through your, you know, the cash generated through your other business.
Good luck, Dino.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
Happy New Year. Bye.
Happy New Year to you. And let's try Andy, and Andy's with us from Sacramento.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I wonder if George would comment on something that happened to me this year. My domain name was spoofed by a spammer, meaning that millions of pieces of spam were sent out in my domain name. And this basically brought my small graphic design firm to its knees, and consequently, my faith in the net as a tool for commerce has been pretty much irrevocably shattered. Any comments about how spam is influencing the use of the net?
Well, first off, you have my sympathies there. It is one of these crimes, you know, taking away, your good name.
Exactly.
It's very hard to track down and punish the person who did it and get them not to do it again. It's very hard.
In this case, we did find the person who did it, and we are, you know, pursuing action against them. But I know lots of people who are so fed up with spam. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine recently just canceled his ISP account altogether. He said, next time I want to write a letter, I'll get it on a piece of paper.
I think, you know, in terms of advice of what you can do, I don't have any good answers. I mean, one thing to be optimistic now about is a lot of people, since it's costing so many large corporations so much money, there's a lot of work being done in figuring out how to deal with the spam problem. I mean, that's a place that
that's a good point.
Pretty sure is attracting venture capital right now, how to get rid of spam, because it's costing people billions.
Well, lots of people are making lots of money selling anti-spam software.
Exactly.
Some of which occasionally even works. Andy, our sympathies to you, and the best of luck with your next venture.
Thank you, Neil.
Okay, and Happy New Year to you.
You too.
George Manis, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil.
George Manis is a senior writer for TheStreet.com. He was with us from his home in Manhattan in New York City. And even as we slowly figure out the rules for doing business on the Internet, the actual nature of what we've created remains a little elusive. The web is the ultimate Frankenstein, a confusing creation of disparate elements, part marketplace, part swap meet, a mixture of library, salon, and barroom, and all the information that gets swapped in those fora. But information on the web can prove frustratingly ephemeral. It turns out that digital history is easily edited and easily lost. In a moment, we'll talk about efforts to archive all that information, but we want to hear from you about how you manage all the data on the web, all the data that the web makes available. Do you stick to the same sites or troll the hinterlands? And do you find favorite sites that later disappear? 800-989-8255 or email us, TOTN@npr.org. Brewster Kahle is the founder of the Internet Archive. He documents the entire web every 2 months. He joins us now from his home in San Francisco, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much.
How do you archive the web every 2 months?
We have a set of machines and partners that have a set of machines that crawl all of the websites by going and asking every website for all the pages and images and documents on them. So all the publicly available websites are archived every 2 months.
It has to remind you of that commercial where the man sitting in front of his computer at home reaches the end of the Internet. He's seen it all.
Yes. Well, the Internet actually is, in some senses, finite in the amount of useful information out there, though the websites often go on and on because they're computer generated. But we do collect about the amount of text that's in the Library of Congress every month.
Now, do you use any filter, or do you just take a picture of everything?
We try to take a picture of everything every 2 months, and then using curators at the Library of Congress in England at the Public Record Office, and also folks in France, we use curators to make more rapid snapshots, say every day, of important segments at important times, like at election times or during war times, so that there's a good historical record that's not just a casual snapshot every 2 months.
So, for example, a lot of people have talked about the way Howard Dean's website has, changed, if not revolutionized, political fundraising. There'd be a better record of that as it evolved over time.
Absolutely. Elections are very important, and we're even finding that government websites sometimes change the past in that sort of Orwellian way. The White House had gone and changed a headline on a past press release, but didn't note the change. They just made the change.
Are there any sites you don't archive?
We don't archive any sites that there are indications that the website owners don't want them archived. So if people put robot exclusions or other indications that they'd like things not archived.
And is there any group of companies characteristically that doesn't want them?
Yes. Some of the newspapers don't want their past archives archived because they're trying to make money out of it. It's a little ironic that the newspaper of record, the New York Times, doesn't want to be archived. But it is understandable that they're trying to make money off of that.
So they're archiving it themselves.
They're archiving themselves, though. In the long haul, corporations don't tend to do a very good job of keeping things up that are not of commercial viability. That's where libraries and archives like ours come in.
Now, one field that's having a lot of trouble adapting to the Internet is scholarly journals. You cite something on the Internet, it's likely to be gone in a few months or years. Are there ways to cope and ways to have footnotes follow that report wherever it may have been URL'd?
Oh, good point. And the average life of a web page is about 100 days before it's changed or deleted. That's the average. And so these scholarly journals that are footnoted, that are referencing other places on the net, it's just constantly shifting sand. So the Internet Archive has archival URLs. So basically it's their original URL with the date that it was crawled. And this way people can refer, and people do actively refer, to the Internet Archive's version of things as a permanent way of gaining access to these materials.
How much of this is just saving stuff because we can? I mean, you'd have to think a lot of this stuff is, there's not a lot of point to saving it.
Oh, I'm sure 99.9 is trash from most people's point of view, but we're finding that lots of people are finding it interesting for different things than you'd maybe originally imagine. So people are using it for research on linguistics, when how different words are evolving, sort of things that you would do in a library. But I think more importantly, it's trying to bring permanence to a very important medium. 80%, a study by Pew Internet Trust, 80% of students use the Internet as their information resource, first resort. And 40% of those students use it as their only resort. So basically, the Internet has become the library. And if the library only has what's in print, and that can be actively changed or modified or deleted, that's a pretty scary area. So where most of it may be trash, or from anybody's one person's perspective might be trash, keeping a historical record and building the library that we can count on intellectually is very important.
Brewster Kahle, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Brewster Kahle, the founder of the Internet Archive, located at archive.org. He is located in San Francisco, California, where we reached him today. You are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And what Brewster Kahle may call an archive, David Schenck might describe as data smog. That's the term he coined to describe the glut of information we have to all negotiate on a daily basis as we go on the web. David Schenck joins us now from his home in Brooklyn, New York. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Neil.
We've all got access to ever more information. Does that mean we have access to more knowledge?
The knowledge is only the stuff that we get inside our heads that we can turn, turning the information into meaning that we can actually use in our lives. I want to set the record straight, though. God bless Brewster Kahle. I mean, he's doing a really, really important thing, and it's very useful in my own life is for writing books.
Uh-huh. Because you're going to be able to go back and document exactly how much data smog there was.
Well, not only that, I mean, I've moved on to different subjects, and I'm one of those quasi-scholars who cites things in books, and I want those citations to be around.
Well, are we adapting to the new information environment, or are we just drowning in data?
I think probably a little bit of both. I mean, there are just incredible possibilities and opportunities here, and I think people instinctively realize that we are in a whole new paradigm. We've very quickly gone from a place where, you know, historically, for thousands of years, we've had this desperate need to scrape up as much useful information as we can, and now we suddenly find, in a span of a couple of years, through the internet and through other electronic means, that we can get our hands on anything very, very quickly, and we very quickly amass more than we can use, and we have to figure out what to do with it.
Well, somebody might find it useful someday, and the cost of computer memory continues to drop, capacity increases, so why not save all this stuff?
I'm not against saving it. It's just a matter of saving it in a useful way. And what I found in my own life, aside from my study of data smog, but just my own life and my study of other subjects, is that I want to use something, I want to either file it well or file it well in my own mind or get rid of it. Because if I just kind of put it on some kind of virtual heap there somewhere, it's not going to be useful to me. It's just going to fill up something, and it's going to kind of clog up my own filing systems at some point.
Well, what you want is an editor.
I try to be my own editor. And what's happened here, along with this big paradigm shift, is that we are now, everyone, it has to be their own editors, since we're our own information librarians and even producers.
So as you search this information that you've gained access to, you have to throw several grains of salt at some of it, and some of it you just got to tote out to the trash.
Well, we just need to realize that this is an incredible opportunity. It's also an incredible challenge. I mean, we all have the power now of being information producers and librarians and so forth, and we just need to be really careful about how we use that power.
Without the pressures of space, are we losing the ability to distinguish what's important?
Well, the value of information does shift when all of a sudden, you know, you punch in a – used to be I've been listening the last couple of minutes. You know, the guy couldn't find any kind of useful food for his store, and now he probably punches in a word for a very rare kind of cheese, and, you know, lo and behold, there are 150 of those stores, and you have to spend a lot of time kind of sorting through all the different possibilities.
So it's both a wonderful and brave new world at the same time.
Absolutely.
David Schenck, thanks very much for being with us
today. Thank you.
David Schenck, the author of Data Smog, Surviving the Information Glut, and he was with us from his home in Brooklyn, New York. When we return from the break, we'll dive into the world of turntable temptations and grooved gold mines with the secret lives of record collectors. Does this sound familiar? Does this indeed sound like you with a basement full of LPs and 45s? Well, turn down the vintage vinyl for a moment and give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN at npr.org. Record collecting after we come back from the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.